and welcome to Worlds Apart. With friends like these, who needs enemies? This phrase, attributed to the late 20th century American comedian Joy Adams, has already become the ethos of the 21st century geopolitics. The US-Israeli attack on Iran has created existential problems for American allies in the Gulf and simultaneously delivered an unexpected economic bonus to its rivals like Russia and India, which for now at least can carry on with their old trade without the overhang of US sanctions. To make sense of it all, I'm now joined by Kani Karahra, an assistant professor of international relations and global affairs at Kautilya School of Public Policy in India. Professor Rahra, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you for having me here.
Now, I know that you began your studies with applied psychology and then moving on to international relations and conflict resolution. When you look at what's happening in the world right now, do you think it can still be explained through the lens of political science or perhaps a psychological or, I would say, psychiatric explanation would be more appropriate?
It's true. I've always struggled with the fact that political science theories are not necessarily complete. But now I think the world is also seeing that more and more, that theories of realism and constructivism are being limited in terms of how much they can explain the world today. And psychology and history are far more are giving us far more structures in terms of how we can understand the world and why states are doing what they do.
Mm-hmm. Now, the reason I'm asking about this tongue-in-cheek, obviously, is because the most typical reaction I hear from ordinary people to what they see in the news is that it's just crazy. So many things that were deemed inappropriate or impossible are happening before our eyes. Do you think, though, there's still a method behind this madness? In other words, do you believe that all these disruptions that we are witnessing, are they a result of planning or perhaps the lack of it?
I mean, when we look at it from an outsider's perspective, we definitely feel that this doesn't make sense at all, whether it's the Venezuela crisis that came through before or the Iran crisis that's happening right now. But I have whatever reading I have of Trump, it seems that there is a method to the madness in some way. At least he knows why he's doing something. We may not see it. But the problem that also happens with the method in madness is you can take an action, but you cannot necessarily control how the world is going to react to it, how states are going to behave and what they're going to do. So there may be a method to his madness and why he's doing what he's doing, but he's not necessarily in control of how the world is going to operate and engage with him.
Well, and he doesn't seem to care about how the world would react. I mean, one of the possible explanations I've heard from policy experts, including in the United States, is that Trump's method is just to come up with a new crisis every time when he faces certain scrutiny at home for the previous one. But if that's indeed the framework, there is no way of escaping this escalation. I mean, the only thing out of it is a nuclear explosion that will put all the problems to rest. But hopefully that, of course, will not happen. But do you think there's anything that can actually put enough pressure on President Trump or the American state at this point of time to, you know, take, you know, pretty obvious consequences of their actions into account?
I think so. I think the like any leader who's been elected, the voter base that makes a lot of difference. And just like it matters for any other state, it also matters for Trump what his voter base thinks and talks about. So if the pressure comes in from the MAGA voter base that we think that it is going to come, it is definitely going to impact how he approaches the Iran crisis or any other crisis that comes in the world. We've seen this before also, because when it comes to the Epstein case, he's constantly been trying to put himself away from the problem because he knows what his voter base is looking for. And when it comes to the current Iran crisis as well, he's done the same. He recently said that he's going to take a pause because he knew that the voter base may have some problems with it.
Mm-hmm. It looks like all of us, I mean, billions of people around the world, are essentially held hostage to the opinions of Trump's voters, be it the MAGA electorate or somebody else. Now, speaking about international law, many of your colleagues here in Russia believe that this latest US-Israeli attack on Iran created a situation where the current legal framework, that is international law, can no longer serve as a basis for international engagements. In fact, perhaps it creates disadvantages for the parties who follow it because the Iranians tried to negotiate prior to this attack, and it only proved to be to that disadvantage. Do you agree with that? And if so, what's likely to replace it?
So international law has always been questioned by those who are, because those in power always tend to abuse it, and those who are not in power tend to follow it more than is required. Earlier, we saw this with Iraq as well. We've seen that the US attacks on Iraq were not in line with what was in international law or with Libya, right? But they still happened. The problem that's happening now, I believe, is that the breaks or the attacks are more frequent. So international law is being attacked from all corners, all the time, everywhere, which means that it gets weakened when people, there's no place for the world to digest that there's been some sort of aberration and then we can come back to it. So international law itself does seem weak. But if you look at how Iran has been engaging with the world, there is a sense of clarity that they are still looking to some sense of structure of international law and trying to uphold its principles in some way, at least. Which gives us hope that international law itself may not be completely dead, but maybe the idea of how international law is being shaped may be taking time to produce.
Well, I think Iran is also pretty clear about not being constrained by international law, rather by the laws of proxy politics, because he goes under American interest in countries where they're located, regardless of territorial integrity. And I think that also creates a new condition in geopolitics, where countries that used to do the American bidding or the bidding of the strongest party are now finding themselves not only on the defensive, but ultimately defenseless. Do you think that may change the sort of the outline of how the powers that be practice what they practice?
I'm sure it will, because there is no way that all the things that are happening right now will not have an impact on how state engagement is going to happen. Even if we go back a little bit and when President Trump announced the tariffs unilaterally with Europe, with India, with so many other countries, there was a sense that we need to look out for ourselves first and we need to understand how the world is functioning before we can say that, you know, just because you're in a partnership or an alliance means that things will work out smoothly for you.
Well, speaking about how the world is functioning, until recently, it was at least assumed that, you know, geopolitical rivals can sort out that things, but that trade, especially oil trade, will go on as usual. And I think the attack on Iran and the Iranian response are now suggesting that no one or very few countries can really sit on the fence. I mean, the shortages that many of the nations are facing in terms of oil supplies. If the Strait of Hormuz is unlocked anytime soon, do you think it will still be business as usual, or do you think that this bedrock of global economy will have to be somehow readjusted or reshaped so that, you know, countries can feel protected from something like this erupting all over again?
I mean, countries can try, because even when we look at supply chains, there's so much dependence on China. So a lot of countries are trying to not be so dependent on China and try other mechanisms to sort of reduce their dependence in some way. So countries may try to reduce their dependence on the Straits of Hormuz, but I'm not sure it can work the same way, because it's a passageway from which travel happens. And those passageways cannot be shifted just because there's a will of countries that they want to be less dependent. So, but coming back to your earlier question on whether once the Straits of Hormuz are opened, will things go back to normal? I doubt that things will go back to normal, because Iran is also a very smart player in the international arena. And it's not going to just give in because Trump stops the war, that Iran now agrees to everything that comes on the table. It's going to make sure that it negotiates for its place in the engagement smartly.
We have already seen a number of critical oil infrastructure, desalination infrastructure being targeted. And I mean, I'm as far away from the epicenter as you are, but when I look at what's happening, it seems very scary. I mean, short of nuclear detonation, this is already, you know, smells of ecological disaster, because if you have all those plumes of smoke all over, spreading all over the planet, that's already a major threat of ecological catastrophe. Do you think that may provide some sort of an impetus for the belligerents and those around them to look at it not from the point of view of conflict resolution, but, you know, bare physical survival of the planet.
I wish that were true. And I hope that the states can see that at some point. But I, based on whatever I've understood of the world today, it doesn't seem possible that because of ecological damage, states will actually change the way they are engaging with the world. There is too much at stake right now. The rules-based order is so weak and the structures are very, very limited. So it's not possible for states today to think so much of ecological damage. They first have to think of their survival. And I think those things will matter more than ecological damage.
Now, as I mentioned before, Iran is going the most painful, vulnerable infrastructure in the American allies. But this conflict also created a very unusual situation for our countries, for Russia and India, because they find themselves in a rather uncanny place where they situationally benefit from what's going on. I'm talking about the temporary lifting of the US sanctions or restrictions on the oil trade between Russia and India. I think for now, both Moscow and New Delhi are quietly pleased with that. But generally speaking, do you think they will accept this framework going forward when that bilateral trade is subject to overseas approval or disapproval?
It's not the most pleasant of situations where your dependence of a bilateral relationship as old as Russia and India's is dependent on a third party. But it's also an unfortunate situation that both the states have to deal with. I think up till now, if you will look at even the cuts of sanctions and the way things have happened between US and Russia, India and Russia have been able to navigate their relationship quite comfortably to the benefit of both. At all times. It has never been to the negative impact of either of those two states, which is why they've been able to manage this so well. And I think that it's one of the few relationships that can manage any of these problems quite comfortably as well.
And India is also very experienced at multitasking. Prior to this conflict, I know that India had good working relations with both Israel and Iran while hoping for a strategic partnership with the United States. Where do you think the Indian sympathies, and by that I mean both the leadership and the people, lie at this point of time? Are they more with Israel or with Iran?
Indian sympathies lie with India. So that's how Indian sympathies are going to be determined and engaged with. But if you will ask from a Global South perspective, Indians are definitely feeling very strongly about the attack that's happened in Iran. We have seen that the Iranian, the Ministry of the Iranian ambassador had also said that he knows that India is with Iran. And there was the big Shia community in India, which has actually sent money and gold to the Iranians because they feel so strongly about the damage that has happened. So there is a sense of understanding both sides and a sympathies lying within India and how India should engage while being careful of what has to happen. But you have to be conscious of the fact that India has to engage with its strategic partnerships and engage with the world simultaneously as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor, we have to be conscious of our time. So let's take a very short break right now, but we will be back to the discussion in a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Kanika Rahra, an assistant professor of international relations and global affairs at Kautilya School of Public Policy in India. Professor Rahra, I do want to ask you about a noteworthy historical coincidence, because I know that Prime Minister Modi was one of the last, if not the last, foreign leader to visit Jerusalem just before the launch of this attack. And 4 years ago, it's interesting that it was Prime Minister of Pakistan at that time, Imran Khan, who was the last foreign leader to visit Moscow before it launched its military operation in Ukraine. Now, Imran Khan seemed to have paid quite a huge political price for traveling that far. I'm sure that fate is not awaiting Prime Minister Modi, but do you think there's any connection, perhaps underground connection, between what is going on in Iran right now and the earlier conflict that is still raging in Ukraine? Are there any perhaps geopolitical patterns that are sourcing both of them?
Well, I'm not sure if there are patterns that are sourcing both of them in terms of the fact that US is involved in both these conflicts. That's probably the one common arena that you would talk about. But just coming back to the point that Prime Minister Modi was the last person to visit Israel, it did create a lot of furor within the Indian security establishment as well. And the strategic community was in divided in parts as to whether this was a planned process, whether India was aware of what Israel had done. Mm-hmm. And the government has come out clearly to say that it was not, that has not come out to say anything on this regard. So which means that it was not involved as much. Mm-hmm. The idea behind the visit was mostly to acknowledge Israel's existence as a reality, which is something that India now, because of its partnership with Israel, looks at. Mm-hmm. But that in no way undermines India's relationship with Iran, which is its historical civilization, and at so many other levels, mm-hmm. That continues to grow ahead. Of course, there are problems within the relationship now because India is also with the BRICS. So there are some situations that may come across. But India is being strategic about how it's engaging with the world and looking at both of its relationships, maintaining both of its relationships.
You know, it just occurred to me that one of the things that is common between the these two conflicts is that Iran had 4 years to observe how this Western proxy war was being played out. The use of drones, I think Iran also had plenty of time to build up its defenses and strategize about how they can be used on the battlefield. But one new development is that Iran, well, Russia actually threatened on a couple of occasions that it may go after the sponsors of the Ukrainian regimes, the countries that are supplying it with weapons. It never actually went that far. It never attacked targets outside the Ukrainian territory. But I think Iran is taking it a step further, much further, some would say. Do you think that's a significant development? Do you think that it may change the way people think about how wars are fought?
So when the Russia-Ukraine crisis sort of came into being, there was a lot of debate about how wars are, how the changing character of war is happening. Iran, I think you're right about it, has been very strategic about its engagement. It cannot have the same engagement with Israel the way Russia had with Ukraine. So it has to be more strategic about other assets, U.S. assets in the region, and it has attacked those. It has carefully planned what it wants to put across to the world as well in terms of its actions. When we're looking at the changing character of war, that, the one thing that definitely comes out is the prolonged nature of war that is going to happen, where life will continue on parallel sides. It's not going to be an all-out war in any region now. Mm-hmm. Even if you talk to people in Dubai, whatever we're hearing from journalists who are down in those spaces, they're saying everything is fine. Sometimes we get alerts, we have to be careful, and then we go on with our business. Mm-hmm. So war is actually coming into, pervading into our lives in a very normalized sort of way, mm-hmm. which is unfortunate.
Interesting you say that, because I think both before the Ukrainian conflict and also with this Iranian offensive, the expectation was that it would be, you know, a blitz, if not a blitzkrieg, then a fairly fast engagement, perhaps only through the air bombardments that all the targets could be taken care of. Do you believe that's still the case? Do you think the Americans and the Israelis will have to send boots on the ground to accomplish their goals, given where the situation is right now?
Well, I find that highly improbable at this point of time, it would be a little hard in terms of engagement. There's also a strong sense of Iranian identity that has managed to sustain and keep the current government in power longer than it may have stayed beyond this if this war had not happened. So it does seem a little far off right now for me in terms of whether boots on the ground can happen. Though it must be said that Iran is one of the few countries that America has attacked and Iran has sustained as well. So it's one of the big things that comes out from this conflict as well, because if you look at Iraq, whether you look at Venezuela, those countries have crumbled after U.S. invasions have happened. This has not, up until now, happened with Iran.
A few moments ago, you mentioned BRICS, and both Russia, India, and Iran are members of this organization. I heard you say before that the future of multilateral engagements, even without this conflict, will revolve around countries joining various groupings, but these partnerships will be narrowly focused. In a way, it sounds like we are returning back to the pre-United Nations era of sovereign diplomacy, are we not?
Possibly, yes, but it would be with a twist, because a pre-United Nations era was also did not have so much space for Asian states. Mm-hmm. Asian states are now more sovereign, have a long part in what is going to happen and engage with the world. So that sort of shift is going to determine a lot of the pre-UN sort of diplomacy that is happening. However, I don't want to take away from the UN and say that it is a completely dead organization at this point of time. I believe that there is space for the UN engagement to happen, because there'll be more sort of equality among states in terms of what they can bring on the table. Mm-hmm. So there may be space for the UN to sort of resurrect and also be an organization that actually works for the benefit of all states.
Well, no doubt the United Nations in principle is a beautiful idea. And whenever I cover it, it reminds me of John Lennon's song, Imagine, you know, imagine all the people sharing all the world and, you know, the world without wars, etc. But just like John Lennon, it seems to have been assassinated by people with omnipotent egos. Do you think the framework of international cooperation, this framework of international cooperation, can still be salvaged, not in rhetoric, but in, you know, meaningful, substantive way of practical geopolitics?
I think so, but just not now. Maybe now is not the time for this to happen. It'll probably take a little longer before the UN can become a place where states can come together. You see that happening a lot with the smaller multilaterals. For example, just with BRICS, if we take the example, we know that states have been able to look after each other within the BRICS organization as well. When it was about Venezuela joining and Brazil was uncomfortable or vetoed Venezuela's joining, the other BRICS states also accepted that. So that's a sort of a space which gives credibility to the fact that BRICS can work together, because the other states are also listening to the grouping or the states in that grouping. Those are the sort of ideas that the UN needs to take forward. And hopefully that will happen sometime in the future.
I agree with you that the BRICS share some of the ethos of the United Nations, at least the practice and the principle of non-intervention, equality, sovereign decision-making. But this organization is clearly facing also a lot of challenging issues, given that Iran and many other Gulf countries are now part of BRICS. How do you think this grouping is going to process or integrate this major disruption within its ranks now?
I'm sure it's a new organization. We have to be cautious of the fact that BRICS came together not necessarily just as an anti-Western organization, but also as an organization of groups that were not the rule setters. They were not the rule makers. So they are coming together. They're trying to figure out how they can work together. There are going to be ups and downs. There are going to be challenges. It's not going to be a smooth ride. It's not that BRICS, for example, BRICS did condemn the Pahalgam attack that happened in India, but they were not able to come together to condemn the Venezuela crisis that happened. So there'll always be challenges to the organization and how it moves forward, but I'm sure it'll meander its way through.
Professor, you mentioned that BRICS is not an anti-Western organization, and its leaders stressed that on many occasions, but do you think that's actually, you know, a genuine statement in this day and age? Because I cannot imagine anyone in Moscow, in Beijing, in New Delhi actually appreciating what happened either in Caracas or in Tehran. Do you think they actually mean what they say?
Yes, of course they mean. When the BRICS come up with a statement, they definitely mean what they say. But it's also because you have to be conscious of your strategic interests while you're making statements in a multilateral system. Multilateralism does not just exist for the sake of existence. It also exists because states want to be a part of it. But states cannot compromise on their national interests for the sake of multilateralism either. And that's something that whether it's Beijing, whether it's Moscow or New Delhi, all will be conscious of when they're approaching any crisis that comes through.
Now, India is chairing BRICS this year, and one of the proposals that the Indian Central Bank has already put on the table is a digital currency exchange to facilitate trade swap deals. Do you think the recent developments, be it in Venezuela or in Tehran, make this measure perhaps a little bit more pressing?
If they make it pressing, it's a good thing because it's beneficial for all state parties concerned. So if all state parties concerned find something that comes through in a multilateral system that benefits everyone, then it's a win-win for everyone. Mm-hmm. And that's something that works for India, that works for Beijing and for Moscow as well. Mm-hmm. And Tehran. Mm-hmm.
And one last question I do want to ask you is about India and China, who are the founding and also most populous members of BRICS, which gives their relationship, their bilateral relationship, a lot of gravitas. And sure, there were tensions before. There were also mutual steps forward. Do you think Beijing and New Delhi may find perhaps a new impetus or, you know, a new reassessment of their relationship in the light of what's been going on between the West and some of its adversaries? Do you think there will be perhaps, a move towards each other a little bit more expressed than before?
So I would not say that any relationship should come together because of a third party. India and China have to work out their problems, have to work with each other, whether it's in multilateral settings or in a bilateral space, because they want to work with each other. And that's something we've seen with the 2024 thawing of relations. Up until even Wang Yi, the foreign minister, has given India's BRICS presidency his approval and has spoken very highly about it. The relationship has to build because both of them want it to build. And when that happens, then it'll be beneficial for BRICS, it'll be beneficial for the world, and it'll be beneficial for Asia.
Okay, well, Professor Rakhra, it sounds very inspiring. Thank you very much for sharing your analysis with us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for watching. See you again next week on Worlds Apart.